Welcome to Little Atoms on Resonance 104.4 FM, a live talk show about ideas and culture, with an emphasis on ideas of the Enlightenment.
Little Atoms is presented by Neil Denny, Padraig Reedy, Richard Sanderson and Becky Hogg, as well as regular guest presenters.
Little Atoms actively promotes science, freedom of expression, scepticism and secular humanism.
Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Little Atoms, tonight with me, Neil Denny, and I'm joined by Professor Ian Stewart. Ian Stewart's best-selling books include Professor Stewart's Cabinet of Mathematical Curiosities, Professor Stewart's Hoard of Mathematical Treasures, and Mathematics of Life. He is Emeritus Professor of Mathematics at Warwick University, where he maintains an active research programme. He is well known for his ability to make mathematics popular, and in 2001 he was awarded the Royal Society's Michael Faraday Medal for furthering the public understanding of science. Ian is also a regular contributor to The New Scientist. His latest book, which we talk about tonight, is 17 Equations That Changed the World.
Well, it's a pleasure to speak to Ian Stewart again. Ian, thanks for talking to Little Atoms again today.
That's fine, Neil. Thank you for letting me do it.
So today we're going to be talking about your latest book, 17 Equations That Changed the World. Now, I'm sure many people will have heard that there's a sort of a canard in the book industry that if you put an equation into a book, then it has a sort of detrimental effect on sales. So how does that work with a book about equations, I wonder?
We decided to tackle this alleged problem with equations head on, right? And I think if you're writing a book about equations, readers are a little more forgiving.
You can't really avoid it.
they can't claim that they weren't made aware that they're going to find a few equations. But, I mean, the response to the book has been amazingly good, in fact. It's clear that there are plenty of people out there who are actually interested in equations.
Sure.
But the point of the book is it's actually, in a sense, I'm aiming it at the sort of person who doesn't actually realise that they might get interested in equations.
Yeah.
And the people are sitting there thinking, well, we sort of did them at school and it was all a bit boring and I never quite got to grips with it properly, and I might have remembered how to do it for the exam, but I've forgotten it all. But what were they for? Where did they come from? Why do we actually bother with them? You know, what's it all about? So the idea of the book was to take, as it turned out, 17 of what I can at least argue are the most important equations that people have come up with over the last 2,500 years. And equation by equation, tell the story of what the world was like before somebody discovered it, who discovered it and in what context, what happened soon after that, how the world started to change as a result of knowing this equation, and then ending up with something that I think is actually quite important here, which is, fine, but what's it doing for us now?
Is there any significance in 17, then?
17 is the number we got it down to by being fairly stringent about which ones we included. I've had at least one complaint, which I actually agree with, that there was one equally important equation to do with elasticity and materials and so forth that really should have gone in as well. So it could have been 18. But when we got to 17, we thought, you know, that's about right for a popular science book. It gives you, I mean, a typical popular science book has about 20 chapters.
Yeah, sure.
So one chapter per equation and bookending it with some sort of introduction and some sort of summary at the end, it feels about right. And then, of course, 17 is a sufficiently intriguing, so it's one of those numbers that sounds as if it's interesting. It's odd, it's a prime number.
Indeed,
It has a slight mystical feel to it, which we shamelessly exploited by thinking, well, actually that makes a better title than, if we made 20, you look at it and say, oh yeah, it's just chosen a round number.
Yeah. Let's start at the very beginning and ask perhaps a daft question, but what exactly is an equation? How do we recognise one?
It's certainly not a daft question, I hope it's not, because it's where I kind of open up by talking about precisely that. An equation is some sort of mathematical statement which says that something or other is equal to something else. And at first sight, the two things that you're being told are equal and therefore the same, they don't look the same. I mean, take the famous equation everybody knows, Einstein's E equals mc squared. Mm-hmm. Well, if you look at it as a bit of algebra, E is one symbol and mc squared is three other symbols, and why on earth should these things be equal? But what the equation says, this is an equation about physics, and it says that the energy E in a mass M is that mass multiplied by the speed of light multiplied by the speed of light again. And you can do the sums, and you discover a small amount of matter gives you a large amount of energy. And suddenly this simple little equation has told you something really quite profound.
Let's start with the first one you tackle then, and this is possibly now not the most famous equation, because you just brought up Einstein's EMC squared, which we'll talk about later, but certainly one that everybody should have learnt at school, and this is Pythagoras' equation. So, yeah, many people will have forgotten this from school, so let's remind us what it is, first of all.
Okay, so Pythagoras' equation, when Pythagoras or his followers or whoever it really was wrote it down, it wasn't even an equation in a symbolic sense. Mm-hmm. It was, however, a sentence which said something or other is equal to something else. So it clearly is an equation, and nowadays we express this in algebra. And it was a basic equation in geometry which told us interesting things about a right-angled triangle. And we can all recite this thing, even if you haven't done it for a long time, it will sound vaguely familiar. The square on the hypotenuse of a right-angled triangle is the sum of the squares on the other two sides. Yes?
Yes, that sounds about right.
And in algebra, this becomes a squared plus b squared equals c squared, where a and b are the other two sides, and c is this hypotenuse beast, which is the longest side. So, you know, you sort of look at this thing and say, well, actually, in symbols, that's quite pretty. Mm-hmm. And what it did, I started with it because it really is the oldest of the equations I wanted to talk about. You can go back to the ancient Babylonians and find quadratic equations even earlier. But in a way, quadratic equations didn't do a huge amount for civilization, despite the way we teach them in schools. Mm-hmm. It's not that they're not important, but they're not kind of front ranking, whereas Pythagoras, actually, it really is. And to see why, I look at the world at the time of the ancient Greeks before Pythagoras, when you didn't really even know what shape the planet was, mm-hmm. you didn't have good ways of measuring land, you didn't, you know, even if the king wanted to tax you, he had trouble working out how much tax to charge and so forth. So after Pythagoras, what comes along following up on Pythagoras' equation is a whole pile of related stuff which turns into trigonometry. Mm-hmm. Trigonometry is the mathematics of triangles. And what it says is, given some information about a triangle, such as a couple of the sides and one of the angles or something like that, you can work out all the rest. You can work out all the other sides, all the other angles. You can work out exactly which triangle you've got. Now, this is fantastic for surveying, because if I want to measure the distance from one mountain peak to another mountain peak, you can't really stretch a piece of string between them. So you have to do it indirectly. But what it turns out, with good instruments, you can measure angles very, very accurately. Distances are much harder. So you start with a baseline, some measured distance, which you basically, you know, you actually use a kind of a sophisticated tape measure to get this very, very accurately. And then from there, you measure angles to other prominent points, calculate distances, calculate other angles. Once you've got one triangle, now you've got three distances that you know. One was measured, two count, and you just build on that. And you can keep going all the way, and when you get to the end, you can measure some distance again just to check that you haven't made silly mistakes along the way. And this is how we mapped the planet.
Moving on from Pythagoras then, you go on to look at, I'd like to look at both of these things together, really, logarithms and calculus, both of which are important foundations of advanced maths. But, you know, these were both things that somebody, for want of a better word, invented. So let's talk about the development of these two things.
Yeah, I think invented is actually a pretty good word here. I mean, people always argue about whether you discover maths or invent it.
But whether or not it's already there and somebody else is the first person to find it.
I think you invent the questions that you're going to ask and the way you're going to think about them to some extent, and then you discover what the logic of that situation tells you. So invention is the creative bit where you choose what problem you're going to tackle. And the logarithms emerge because if you go back into about the 1400s and so forth, you've got astronomers trying to calculate the motion of planets in the sky and things of this kind and eclipses and stuff. And these are really, really hard sums, lots and lots of arithmetic. It all has to be done by hand, and it takes an extraordinarily long time. And surveying, which I've just been talking about, the same thing there. You have to do all the trigonometric calculation. And John Napier, who was a Scottish baron, realized that there was a simpler way to do multiplication sums. There was a bit of a problem with it, but the basic idea was you could turn multiplication into addition. Think about this. If you multiply 100 by 1,000, mm-hmm. what's the answer? Well, it's 100,000. But if you count the noughts, you've got two noughts, and then you multiply by one followed by three noughts, and the answer has five noughts, and that's 2 plus 3. Mm-hmm. So 10 to the power 2, that is 10 times 10, multiplied by 10 to the power 3, that is 10 times 10 times 10, is, count how many 10s you've got, 5. So it's 10 times 10 times 10 times 10 times 10. 100,000. Okay? So in a sense, that's converted that multiplication sum with 100 and 1,000 into a much simpler addition sum with 2 and 3. Now, if all you could do was numbers that went 1 and a lot of zeros, this wouldn't be terribly useful. But basically the idea is if instead of using 10, you use a number like 1.0000001 mm-hmm. and calculate powers of that, just keep multiplying by that number, you get a whole pile of numbers which are very, very close to each other. So pretty much anything you're interested in is approximated by one of those. So you can multiply a couple of numbers by just looking them up in this table and adding the corresponding things together and then seeing where that occurs in the table.
And somebody had to do all of that calculation.
You've hit the nail on the thumb very firmly here. Someone had to do that calculation. But once one person's done it, as long as he's got it right, everyone else can use it and you don't have to do it again. So it's almost like doing all possible multiplication sums in one go. But it's cleverer than that because the actual list is shorter. So it's a systematic way of turning multiplication into addition.
So let's move on to calculus then. People will probably be familiar with the sort of the debate between Newton and Leibniz over this. But let's talk about the actual sort of the gestation of it.
Okay, for Newton, this idea came out of problems in mathematical physics, basically. For Leibniz, it was more philosophy. It was kind of Newton the applied mathematician and Leibniz was the pure mathematician. And they both honed in on the same idea, and it's much easier to understand if you think the way Newton did. Suppose you've got a car travelling along the road, and you know that in 1 hour it goes 50 miles. What's its speed? Well, it may not have gone at the same speed all the time, but over that whole period, it's essentially done 50 miles an hour. But if you start saying, now, I don't want to know what its average speed is over some long period of time. I want to know how fast it's travelling now as I'm putting my foot on the accelerator or braking to slow down for a lorry or something. What's the instantaneous speed? Does it make sense and how would you measure it? Mm-hmm. And basically what Newton says is, yeah, well, look, suppose you take where the car is now and you look 1 second into the future and see where it is then. Or if you like, 1 second into the past, where was it? Take the distance it's travelled, divide by 1 second, it's that amount of distance per second. But if you're going to be really, really pedantic, you say, but that's the average over 1 second. It could have been a bit faster at some points and a bit slower at other points. That's not the instantaneous. So Newton says, okay, take something shorter than a second. Yes, I know there's going to be the same objection, but we can make it shorter and shorter and shorter and shorter and shorter and do the sum in each case. And we can ask what the answer looks like when that time interval gets as close as you want to zero. And what happens if you do this with a particular mathematical formula, for example, you get a very sensible answer. And if you draw pictures or do calculations, it actually looks pretty good. So for Newton, this idea of taking smaller and smaller and smaller quantities is a kind of process. He's not saying take a fixed quantity that is smaller than anything else, because there isn't such a thing. If you take something half as big, it's smaller. So there's just no way to have that. But you can kind of find a form of words which almost does that. And this is the basis of calculus. And as well as the debate about who invented it, and scholars still argue about it, but Newton and Leibniz did it sort of independently. The problem is everybody, all the intellectuals and mathematicians in those days had some sort of idea what everyone else was doing. Mm-hmm. So these ideas were floating around. You can argue that Fermat, of Fermat's Last Theorem fame, actually did the basic idea 100 years earlier. So it's a bit of a fruitless debate, and it makes a lot of sense to just give sort of equal credit to them both. Newton, of course, did much more with it than Leibniz. He based a whole pile of important mathematical physics on it. Although when he wrote it up for his famous book, The Mathematical Principles of Natural Philosophy, he chucked all the calculus out because he was worried that people wouldn't actually understand it and that the same kind of issue would come up about, hang on, what does this all mean? So he used clever geometric arguments instead. It's the sort of thing Archimedes might have done about 2,000 years earlier.
If Newton had, if calculus was all Newton had come up with, we'd be still talking about him now, because that's an incredible achievement. But of course, you then go on to talk about his other little achievement, which is the laws of gravity.
Well, that's right. I mean, that's not the only one. He did a whole pile of things in optics, and he also did his laws of motion, which I sneak into the calculus chapter as the motivation for doing the whole thing. So that saves me a chapter on Newton's laws of motion. But Newton's law of gravity, coupled with Newton's law of motion, tells us how the planets move and how other astronomical bodies move. And it's not absolute frontier physics anymore, but it's still good enough for NASA to use it for almost all space missions. What Newton realised was you could take things that his predecessors had discovered, especially Johannes Kepler, who was a German, a very interesting mathematical mystic, I think is the way to describe Kepler. He looked for patterns everywhere, and sometimes he found real patterns, and sometimes he thought he saw patterns when they didn't really exist. But for the motion of the planets, buried in amongst a whole pile of cosmic speculation, are three laws. He was looking at the planet Mars, and basically the point is that Mars moves around the Sun in an ellipse, which is a slightly flattened sort of circle. And he had another law saying roughly how fast it moves at any point on the ellipse. And there's yet another law which says how the different ellipses followed by different planets relate to each other, mm-hmm. and how the size of the ellipse relates to the time it takes the planet to go around the Sun. So Jupiter's a lot further out than we are. It takes a lot longer to go round. But there's a nice mathematical relationship between the two. Anyway, so Kepler had these laws, but they were for individual planets as if the others didn't exist. Mars follows an ellipse provided you ignore slight effects from somewhere like Jupiter, which is a pretty big planet and actually does alter Mars's orbit somewhat, if you, you know, over thousands of years maybe, but nonetheless it has an effect. Newton looked at this and said, you know, I can turn all of this into a nice mathematical formula for the force between any two bodies caused by gravity. You know, there's the story of Newton and the apple, and some people dispute it, but it was Newton's biographer who claimed he got it from Newton. You know, he was sitting and he saw an apple fall, and for some reason he thought of the moon going around the Earth, which is totally different because it's not falling. And then he had this sudden brainwave. Actually, the moon is falling, but it's moving sideways as well. So the moon is falling all the time, but the Earth is falling away beneath it. And that's why it goes round and round. And probably in his head, he then did the sums and discovered the apple is falling at just the right speed to make sense of the moon. Right? So suddenly what goes on down here and what goes on up there are all part and parcel of one big thing. And Newton just writes down an equation for this. He deduces it from Kepler's laws, in fact. And it says if you have two bodies, the force between them is proportional to the mass of each body, and it goes like one over the square of the distance. So if they're twice as far apart, it's a quarter of the force. So suddenly you've got a tool for analysing not just one body, but for all bodies, everything.
You're listening to Little Atoms, today with me, Neil Denny, and I'm talking to Professor Ian Stewart about his latest book, 17 Equations That Changed the World. So in the second half, I want to look at a few of the equations that you mentioned that we could possibly say have been misused in some way. So right. First of all, normal distribution, which is an important aspect of probability that people will be familiar with. But what does that actually mean before we go on to look at some of its uses and its abuses?
Okay, the statisticians and probability theorists, which are the kind of applied and pure side of the business, came upon this idea from two different directions, but they all ended up looking at the same thing. And it's probably the easiest one to think of is the person who started the whole of statistics, who was a Frenchman called, or was he French? Maybe Belgian. Anyway, somebody called Adolphe Quetelet, and he measured things like heights of people. And when he plotted a graph showing how many people had a particular height, he'd take 1,000 people, and you know he would do it in metric, but 5'1", 5'2", 5'3", how many people have got these heights? And then he drew a picture of this, and he got this beautiful bell-shaped curve, as they say. It looks more like a bell than anything else you can think of, but it's not quite like it. But it's got a hump in the middle, and it tails off at the sides. And this is called the normal distribution. And what Quetelet found was an enormous number of social variables, people's heights, people's weights, the divorce rate, suicide, all of these seem to conform to this same general curve. At the same time, astronomers thinking about errors in their measurements discovered that the errors they would inevitably make when looking through telescopes and measuring things also follow this kind of curve. And what the curve tells us is there's a very high probability of being very close to the thing in the middle, which is probably the accurate value. And then as you get further away from that, the probability of making a mistake that big gets quite a lot smaller. And it actually tails off very, very fast. The mathematicians, meanwhile, have found that if they were thinking about things like tossing coins 100 times and plotting a picture of how many heads they got, what was the chance of getting 100 heads, 99 heads, 98 heads, 50 heads, and so on, they got the same shape curve. And in fact, by analysing the coin tossing model, they could write down a mathematical formula for what Quetelet had just found by empirical measurement. And this is this thing called the normal distribution. Mm-hmm. So there's a rather more complicated formula than most. It's not horrendous as such things go, but it's a little bit, it's got a bit more going on in it than many of the formulas that are important, many of the equations. But this is a kind of universal description of variability in nature, in mathematics, and even in human society. So, the problem and the abuse comes when you decide this really is universal, mm-hmm. that in a sense this is not just a very convenient and widespread shape to find, it's the only thing that can possibly happen. And you start taking your mathematical model too seriously. And one of the places where this kind of thing showed up and has become increasingly controversial and led to all sorts of disputes is the measurement of intelligence. You administer tests to individuals and you come up with their IQ, their intelligence quotient is 95 or 120 or 146 or whatever, and the bigger it is, the more intelligent they are. And you plot these numbers against how many people have that level of intelligence, and you get this beautiful bell curve. And so it's tempting to think about all sorts of questions to do with intelligence in terms of the mathematical ideal, the bell curve. Now, to what extent is it inherited is one of the big questions. Do people in different walks of life, people with different backgrounds, black people, white people, have different levels of intelligence? And you can do all sorts of measurements and apply this bell curve as if it corresponds to reality, and depending on how you do this, you can come up with things which from some political points of view sound very sensible, and from other political points of view sound like a pile of nonsense, and the maths and the politics and everything else all get tangled up. So what I try to do in the chapter, as well as telling the history of this bell curve, is to take a look at some of the reasons why we have to be a bit careful about how we use it. Mm-hmm. For example, with intelligence tests, one of the problems is that people actually assume a bell curve in order to calibrate the test. You test a lot of people, you get scores, you look at it, and you say, it doesn't actually look much like a bell curve. So we have to modify the number until we turn it into the bell curve. It's not completely stupid because it kind of standardizes them all. The big question is whether, in fact, there is a single numerical measure that corresponds to intelligence in any meaningful sense. You know, what is intelligence? Is it really one-dimensional? Mm-hmm. And I don't think it is. This doesn't mean that IQs are completely wrong, but they capture one aspect of intelligence at best. And it may not be a real aspect. It could be a mathematical fiction, which just happens to correlate fairly well with the general feeling these people are really quite clever.
Moving on from that then, another example of something that's been perhaps used politically by people with a certain vested interest is the second law of thermodynamics, which you talk about. So let's describe what that is and what that tells us, first of all.
Okay, it basically, in fact, there's an old Flanders and Swan humorous song which goes, you can't move heat from a hotter to a cooler, because the heat in the hotter will get cooler as a ruler, and so on. But it's actually basically what it says. It says that if you bring a hot body into contact with a cooler body, the heat goes from the hot one to the cold one and not in the opposite direction. And you think, well, that's not terribly profound, is it? But it starts to become profound when you link it to the idea that heat is vibrating molecules. So the idea is the molecules in a hot body are vibrating a lot more than those in a slow body. So you put the hot body with very rapidly vibrating molecules together, you know, it's like something that's shaking very, very hard, and you put it up against something that's not shaking very much, and the one that's not shaking very much is the one that starts to shake more, and the one that was shaking a lot ends up shaking a little bit less. It loses some heat across. But if you start thinking on the levels of molecules, what you've got is just a system of molecules that's jiggling around, and the reasonable model for these things is basically they're a bit like tiny spheres bouncing off each other and obeying Newton's laws of motion. And in fact, this is how the laws of thermodynamics can be derived. Mm-hmm. You can do it from experiments, or you can actually get it in a fairly rigorous way from statistical mechanics, from the movement of these little particles. Now, the thing about Newton's laws is if you run time backwards, the laws look exactly the same. And in simple cases, this makes a lot of sense. I throw a ball in the air and wait for it to come back down again. Mm-hmm. And if you took a picture, a video of that and ran it backwards, it would look like me throwing in a ball in the air and waiting for it to come down again. Mm-hmm. However, if you take a video of me taking a flower vase and smashing it on the floor and run it backwards, it doesn't look terribly convincing. You have this smashed glass on the ground, comes together spontaneously to create a vase, leaps into the air and ends up in my hand. But Newton's laws say, actually, that behaviour, if you knew every detail, if you could trace the vibrations in the floor that come in from the distance and all happen to conspire to hurl these bits of glass together and throw them into the air, it would actually work. Now, what the second law of thermodynamics states is, yes, but that kind of behaviour, this sort of back-to-front behaviour, is extraordinarily unlikely. Mm-hmm. The most probable behaviour not the only possible behaviour, but the one you will actually see in practice with overwhelming probability, is the one that moves in the direction we're familiar with. It's where things smash but don't reassemble. It's where the heat goes from the hot body to the cold body. Yet it could in principle go the other way, but you could wait the lifetime of the universe without actually seeing it happen. So that's the law.
Now, I mentioned that, you know, the idea that this has been used politically. The second law of thermodynamics is the big gun in the armoury of creationists battling the ideas of evolution.
That's right. Creationists, and they would say they're not being political.
Of course.
We can discuss it either way, actually. It doesn't make a great deal of difference to the argument. Okay, so the idea is you interpret the second law of thermodynamics as saying that basically, it says that you can't get order from disorder. Mm-hmm. So how come evolution starts with chemicals in the sea, a sort of disordered primeval soup of chemicals, and somehow produces you and me? Mm-hmm. We would like to think we are a lot more ordered than the soup of chemicals in the sea. So from that point of view, the second law of thermodynamics seems to prove that evolution is impossible.
There's a sort of rather fatuous example of about, you know, you wouldn't expect a gust of wind to go through a scrapyard and end up with a jumbo jet at the end of the afternoon.
That's right. No, indeed you wouldn't. Nonetheless, jumbo jets do in fact get put together somehow. Yes, okay, through the agency of human beings. But there are other examples where the natural behaviour of various systems often produces complex things from simple things. You do get order coming from disorder. So there's an interpretational problem with the second law of thermodynamics. It's true, give or take the very rare exceptions, for molecules bouncing off each other in a gas. It's not clear that it's true as soon as you have other kinds of forces occurring. In fact, the most obvious example is the formation of galaxies. If you have, let's contrast the two cases. If you have a gas, which is molecules bouncing off each other at random, little particles, what happens is the gas automatically and spontaneously spreads itself out so that it's the same pressure everywhere. Basically, every bit of the gas looks the same as every other bit, except at very fine levels, fine detail. If you have a gas of gravitating particles, they don't do that at all. They start to clump together. If two of them are a little bit closer than the average, they will move close, they will attract each other, and the background won't hold them apart. The effect of all the others will not hold them apart. So gravitating systems tend to collapse into clumps. And clumps are more ordered than the uniformly spread out gas. So even in a gravitating system, the whole direction in which things move is arguably from disorder towards order. And the second law of thermodynamics doesn't really work there. Mm-hmm. It was never invented to do so. It wasn't supposed to be about gravitation. It wasn't supposed to be about chemical molecules. It was supposed to be about molecules that don't interact chemically. They just bounce off each other when they hit. Now, as soon as you start to look at the development of life, and the standard story is it starts as some kind of chemical soup and things get more complicated, and at every stage there are these selection procedures that happen. The things that work in some way do something more interesting than other things are the ones that tend to survive. And it gets to the stage where the molecules can copy themselves. And the ones that can copy themselves, obviously, are going to dominate over the ones that can't. Mm-hmm. Because once you've got one, you've got millions. So that sort of system, the selection aspect of it, you try lots of random variations, but then you throw away a whole pile of them in a very ordered way. So that somehow the structure of the system starts to introduce an element of order, not at the random variation part, but in the selection part. The selection is going to have a direction. The stronger animals will beat the weaker ones. The faster ones will beat the smaller ones. Not always, and not if they're clever enough, but certain strategies will work better than other strategies. You don't just toss a coin every time. Now, if I'm up against a lion, the outcome, if you take 100 copies of me against 100 lions, the outcome is not going to be 50-50 for me and the lion.
Right.
I guarantee the lion is going to win every single time. In that sort of competition, the lion is fitter than me. And the other thing is evolution doesn't just randomly assemble stuff anyway. It tends to build, if you like, modules. And modules are little collections of things that do something interesting in their own right. So if you started to go through a scrapyard and looked around and thought, those two bits, like, if you stuck them together, it would make something that goes round and round a bit, some little component of some motor. And then you found another module that said, if I was got fuel in that bit of it, then the other bit would start to burn the fuel. And if you put together things like this at random, kept the ones that looked like they might be useful for making some gadget, after a while you wouldn't have a scrapyard anymore. What you'd have is a collection of spare parts and bits and pieces for something. And if you did it again, you'd start to have a collection of, let's telescope this a little bit, you'd have a collection of, there's a bit that looks like a wing, there's a bit that looks like an engine, there's a bit that looks like the tail of an aircraft, there's things that look like seats. And if you repeat this process many, many times, you actually could assemble something like a jumbo jet from the right scrapyard. Furthermore, you don't have to have the jumbo jet as a target to do this, although you wouldn't end up with a Boeing 747 if you did this. You'd end up with something else. Mm-hmm. But you would end up with something interesting that did some really quite remarkable things. And evolution on the whole actually proceeds in this kind of bit-by-bit manner. It puts together little bits and pieces. It put together bacteria. And then the bacteria and other things combined to create the kind of cells that go towards making multicellular animals. And then those cells started to join up into simple animals and so on and so forth. And it's not as straightforward as that. And you shouldn't take everything I say as gospel. But that's the general gist of it. And it's not a thermodynamic system. And in any case, there's a huge energy input coming from the sun. So the system is not isolated. So the laws of thermodynamics don't apply in any case.
Okay, well, to finish up then, let's have a look at one more equation. And anybody that's been counting as we go along will notice that we've obviously not covered all 17, so there's lots more of interest in the book. But this last one is one that people won't necessarily have heard of by its name, but it's had something of an impact. And this is the Black-Scholes equation, or sometimes known as the Midas equation. So tell us what that was, and then, you know, what happened as a result.
Okay, this is the equation that contributed in some sort of way to what led up to the financial crisis. It's very easy to take a simplistic view and say, oh, it's the equation that caused the banking crisis. And that's not really true. I mean, I have an article I did on the internet with that title, but that wasn't the title I gave it. The title I gave it was, did an equation cause the banking crisis, which is a slightly different point. And if you read the article, it says, well, yes and no. This is a marvellous equation. It's an application of mathematics to an area that most of us probably don't realise maths has been used for, which is the financial system, and not just the sort of day-to-day bookkeeping in a bank, but the investments that the bank makes, the rather more speculative investments in the market. And it was invented to put a sensible price to a financial option. Now, an option is something like, I say to you, look, I'm in the rice growing business, you're in the business of selling rice to people who want to eat it, and we all know that the price of rice goes up and down quite a lot. So let's get together and guarantee a price 6 months hence. I will sell you rice at a certain price in 6 months' time, and if at that point you're happy that the market has not changed so that you can get it a lot cheaper, you will agree to buy it at that point. You'll have the option of changing your mind if it's cheaper. So I'm betting the price is going to go up, mm-hmm. and you're hedging against the possibility that it does go up. Mm-hmm. But both of us now feel much happier because we have a guarantee. So now we have this contract, and we've signed this contract. In 3 months' time, somebody else comes along, and I say to them, I've got this interesting contract to sell rice. Okay, the price of rice has actually gone in quite a nice direction. It's going up. So this contract is definitely going to be worth something. Would you like to buy it from me? I don't really want to sell the rice anymore. And the other person says, yeah, but what is that contract worth? Can we sensibly agree? You know, we can either say, well, you know, he'll offer me £800 for it. I'll say, no, I want 950, and we can haggle and we'll come to some price. Mm-hmm. But we're both guessing. You know, we have some feeling in the back of our minds based on experience what it's worth, but we don't actually have a good number. Now, if you're going to do huge amounts of this kind of trading, you've got to do it pretty much by computer. You cannot have human beings sitting there in the loop all the time, weighing up every possibility. By the time they decided what to do, someone else has got in there. If it's a good bet, and, you know, it just isn't worth it.
Yeah.
So something else had to come in. And the Black-Scholes equation is a rational way to put a price on a financial option before it matures. It's rational in the sense that everyone can agree on the same procedure. And they can agree on the principles behind that procedure. And one of the big principles is this should be risk neutral. Your risk of making a big loss or your risk of making is kind of compensated for by your chance of making a decent profit.
Sure.
And the whole thing has a certain value anyway. So on average, it ends up with the value that it always had all along. But you can spot bargains and nip in there and get something good. And so the equation gave a rational way to do this. And I say rational in the sense that everyone could agree on it and they knew what the assumptions and limitations were.
So what went wrong?
What went wrong was that those assumptions and limitations don't always apply. If the market conditions are not what the mathematical models assume, it doesn't work. And it wasn't really for this equation that that was the problem, although we had an earlier run of the same trouble for models pretty close to this equation, when a hedge fund called Long Term Capital Management, which was using mathematical trading models, ran into the teeth of the Russian financial crisis and lost billions and billions of dollars and went bankrupt. And it was using the Black-Scholes equation and similar related things. I think by the time we got to the full-blown recent financial crisis, indeed the ongoing financial crisis, that equation as such was not the problem. But a lot of this algorithmic trading using mathematical models, and the worst effect was using a bit of mathematical mumbo-jumbo to justify taking risks which any sane person would realise don't make a lot of sense. I mean, the way the entire banking world managed to convince itself that lending huge amounts of money on mortgages to people who cannot possibly afford to ever pay it back just does not make sense. What they seem to think would happen would be, oh, well, look, if they default, we'll take the house and sell it. House prices are going up all the time, no problem. Nobody seems to have thought, or if they did, they kept quiet about it. Yeah, but what happens if every bank in the world is trying to sell millions of houses all at the same time? There won't be any buyers, not as many. The price is going to drop. They won't be worth what we think they're worth. We're going to lose money. And of course, this is exactly what happened. So it was an abuse, not of this equation as such, but it's kind of symbolic, and it had its own sort of mini version of the whole thing. But the abuse of that kind of thinking, coupled to some really rather silly forms of risk-taking, which government regulators should have made sure were impossible. And with hindsight, everyone can see this. Even the bankers admit with hindsight, well, perhaps we shouldn't have done that.
They
don't seem to have got the message that actually they should have been exercising some foresight and seen it coming and not done it. So governments are going to have to regulate them. And then the question becomes, what sort of regulation is going to work? And you need mathematical models, poor as they may be, to explore the possibilities for regulation. So, unfortunately, some of the mathematical models are fairly robust. And this is what you want. You want things that do not depend in excruciating detail on very, very specific assumptions about how markets are going to behave. Because markets are run by people. And even though the market forces have their own kind of mind, that's a collective effect of all the people, and people can do very strange things at times.
Finally then, and you sort of touched on this at the beginning, but I was going to ask you which equations, if any, you would have included if you were writing a book of more than 17. Which did you sort of really have to struggle to leave out?
The one that was very convincingly presented to me as one I should have included is one that I didn't struggle to leave out because it didn't occur to me. There's a nice TV series going on at the moment by Mark Miodobnik on materials. And he said to me, you didn't have an equation for material science. What about Young's modulus? What about the Hooke's equation for a spring? How an elastic material responds to forces that act on it, because that equation and all of the more sophisticated ones that followed are at the basis of almost every engineering structure in the world. And when he said this, I thought, oh my lord, he's absolutely right. I could have done a wonderful chapter on that. It would have been 18 equations that changed the world, but maybe I would have thrown something else out. So that was a genuinely serious omission. Other equations, there you could probably find another 20 that have, a pretty strong claim. But that one has a very strong claim.
You've been listening to Little Atoms. I've been talking to Professor Ian Stewart about his book 17 Equations That Changed the World, which is out now from Profile Books. Ian, thanks for speaking to Little Atoms again.
It's been a great pleasure. It's been a lot of fun. Thank you.
You've been listening to Little Atoms. You can find details of upcoming guests at our website, littleatoms.com. The Little Atoms podcast is available on iTunes. Thanks for listening.